Hebrews 11, verse 23 says, "By faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, because they saw he was a proper child, more handsome than Charlton Heston, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment." Now, you also want to have your finger in Exodus 1, because we're going to have to turn there to get part of the picture. What the scripture's doing here is giving us the link between Joseph as he dies in Egypt and the beginning of God working in the life of Moses is this verse 23 where it says, "By faith," then it should be parentheses, "Moses, when he was hid 3 months by his parents." It's the faith of his parents we're looking at here. Moses didn't demonstrate any faith by being hid for 3 months when he was 3 months old. It's by faith Moses was hid by his parents. So we're looking at the faith of his parents. That is the link into the life of Moses, and it is that thread of God's working we see continue as the faith of these parents are exercised in their home. Now, it is in an era of change. Exodus 1 tells us that. In verse 7, it says, "The children of Israel were fruitful," Exodus 1:7, "and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them." It is a grammatical form with all those "ands" in there to make emphasis to the point that there is a great change in the number of the people. They are growing, they are flourishing in Goshen. And we have some interesting changes here that we're not all sure of. We know that somehow, between the 13th and the 18th dynasties in Egypt, as the children of Israel had come down with Jacob, 75 souls, that during that time, evidently an invasion by some people who have their roots in the Phoenician area, the Phoenician type of people, came down, called the Hyksos kings, or the shepherd kings, the Hyksos dynasties, and they showed great favor during this period of several hundred years to the children of Israel. The Egyptians called the shepherds the Fenshu. They held them in, they despised them, and it may have been because of this era, but at any rate, these shepherd kings came down and ruled the Upper Nile for several hundred years, and under them, the children of Israel flourished. They learned writing, they learned geometry, they learned medicine, they learned agriculture. They were formed and forged into a nation. But then the Bible tells us that time of change came, and God had told Abraham in Genesis 15 that under affliction he would bring them out, yet with great substance. So it is an era of change, as the era of change we live in today. An era, it seems, where this nation has flourished for several hundred years. We have held as a people to certain absolutes, and I think maybe even our parents didn't understand why, but homosexuality was wrong, divorce was wrong, abortion was wrong, and nobody knew why, but it was just wrong. It happened, but it was wrong. And those were absolutes. They were built into our society. They were important. They helped keep us as a nation. Now, in one generation, those things have turned around to where the people who believe in righteousness and in goodness and in family values are the people who are in error. And the people who want to exercise these other things that used to be wrong are the people who are open-minded, supposedly, and people who understand what should be happening. So we are also in an era of change. And it says here in verse 8 that a new king arose. There arose over Egypt a king which knew not Joseph. Acts chapter 7, when Stephen is speaking, which is always a great commentary in the Old Testament, says another king arose, and it's used the Greek word heteros, another of a different kind. And the idea is now another pharaoh comes on the scene. Evidently, either the Egyptians or another people had driven out the Hyksos dynasty. They take over that area of Upper Egypt again, which is Lower Egypt, only it's on the other side of the equator, so it's all confused. "There arose a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph, and he said to his people, 'Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we are. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies, and they fight against us, and get them up out of the land.'" They began to put them into bondage at this point in time, and a conspiracy was formed by this Pharaoh. You know the story. He began to afflict them and make them serve with rigor, it says. He asked Shua, and it gives the names of the Hebrew midwives here, Sifra and Pua, that when the male children were born, they were to put them to death. The Hebrew midwives feared God and spared the male children of the Hebrews. And that came to the attention of Pharaoh. And when he questioned them, they said, well, the Hebrew women are in better shape than the Egyptian women. You know how the Egyptian women have these long deliveries. Well, the Hebrew women pop them out like that. Before we can get there, they're born and they're hidden already. So then Pharaoh asked the Egyptian people then. He asked his own people, when you see any male children born to the Jews, to throw them into the Nile River. And you see, behind all of this is Satan. We see him working in Genesis 5. We see him working here. We see him working with Athaliah in 2 Chronicles 22:10 when they try to destroy all the royal seed in Judah. And all of this, as we followed along, is a conspiracy to stop the Messianic line. Esther and Haman trying to kill all the Jews, with Herod in the New Testament killing all the children in Bethlehem. Behind all of that is Revelation chapter 12. Behind all of those things and behind all the conspiracies in the world today, there's a greater conspiracy that began in the Garden of Eden, and that is that Satan is working behind the scenes and would love to destroy God's people. And Egypt today would love to destroy our children with a different death, and it might be slower, but ultimately it would be eternal. And you and I are facing a circumstance with some pharaoh in one form or another that is seeking today to suppress the values that you and I hold, the God that we believe in. Interesting, while Russia is crying out for help, our own nation is trying to stop what little hope we have as a nation. And in the middle of that, we see these two people, the parents of Moses, Amram and Jochebed. Now, when I say those two words, you're probably as unfamiliar with them as anyone else would be. And there's a beauty to that, you see. We've been studying this chapter on faith. And as we look at the faith of Noah and see the incredible thing he accomplished, or we look at the faith of Abraham sojourning all those years, offering up Isaac, we look at the faith of Isaac, or we look at the faith of Jacob coming down into Egypt and the ladder at Bethel, or we look at the faith of Joseph as he rules over a world empire with Pharaoh, and we see these tremendous things that are accomplished by faith. But now the Bible boils down this line of faith to a mother and a father of whom most of us are not even familiar with their names, who accomplished no great thing in the sense of outward appearance on the part of God, yet through their personal faith, the link is made as we followed along from Joseph to Moses, and thereby a continuation of the nation of Israel, thereby the coming of the Messiah into the world, thereby you and I are sitting here today saved, today because of Amram and Jochebed, because of the faith they exercised when all of the male children were being slaughtered in Egypt. And there's a beauty to that because, you see, it boils it down to this biblical faith can be exercised by obscure slaves in an innumerable multitude that would never have been known except for their commitment as parents, and thereby affecting the world. And the idea is you and I, right in our homes, as grandparents, as parents, or as brothers and sisters, or as children to parents, or in a relationship with the people we work with. We work in the arena of 1,000 relationships that will never be brought into the public eye, where God is asking us to be wise stewards and good stewards over the people that we live with and the eyes that we look in and the people that we care about, and in those environments for us to be men and women of faith. And it's the same kind of faith that Joseph exercised when he ruled over an entire nation, is the same kind of faith that is exercised quietly and privately where no one else sees it but God alone. And that's the beauty of this verse to me, is here are these two unknown people exercising faith in the face of the threat that comes from Pharaoh. No monumental thing is accomplished outside the realm of motherhood, as it were. Jochebed and Amram are born in Egypt. We have little history of Amram, the father. In fact, in Exodus 1, it tells us that Jochebed did all this. Hebrews alone tells us parents, plural, were involved. Jochebed we know little of, besides the information we have here, but one of the very interesting things about this woman is her name. Because as we follow this history of the Jewish people, it seems that God had revealed himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, the Almighty, and had not revealed himself to the nation as Yahweh until the burning bush. Yet, Jochebed is the first name in the Bible that is compound with the Yahweh name. And it means Yahweh is my glory, or the glory of Yahweh, long before the burning bush. So whether this woman, and we're not sure, is given that name by Moses as he writes the Torah, maybe she had an Egyptian name we don't have here, we're not sure, or whether she took that name to herself by understanding the covenant that was made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in some way, we don't know, or whether there was some annunciation we don't have record of, we're not sure. But remarkably, we see the name of this woman and the faith that she exercised. Now, by the way, Moses, we don't know his Jewish name. We don't know what he was originally named. When Pharaoh's daughter drew him out of the river, she gave him an Egyptian name that we're not sure of, that meant to draw out. Hence, Moshe, Moses, the name we have, is a Jewish translation of whatever that Egyptian name was. But this woman exercised a faith, and I think that's important for us to see because she did not have dare to discipline. And I think we should read it, it's great. She did not have a copy of the scripture. She didn't have all the thousands of pages of literature that we have telling us how to be parents. But she had the one thing that is central, and it's the one thing that needs to be there, or all those other things will fail. Because children learn by example, and more is caught than taught. And Gail Irwin gives us, I love, the best example when he says, I tried to teach my kids to eat with table manners, but they eat like me. Because they're imitators. And what Jochebed and Amram had was a faith that overcame the fear of man. They had less information than we do. They had no books on parenting. And yet, they counted the life of this child more dear than their own. They counted the will of God more important than their own life. Whatever their faith was, and however educated it was the kind of faith that was willing to stand up when other people were afraid at the stake of its own life. And it was that example of faith that instilled things in Moses that set him on his course and changed the world. And the idea is this: we can have all the information, and when our kids watch us in private, if we're phonies, that's what they learn to imitate. If our faith in Jesus Christ is the kind of faith that causes us to have some backbone and stand up for what we believe and overcome the fear of man, because the fear of man brings a snare, and we're not afraid to be honest with our relatives and with our friends and with our employers and our employees, and we're willing to stand up for what we believe and not compromise, that's noticed, and it becomes part of the heritage of the generation that comes after us. And when it's a living and genuine faith, and not an empty religious form. And Amram and Jochebed, it says, they look at the child and they saw that he was proper. Here, in chapter 2 of Exodus, it says, there went a man, Amram of the house of Levi, took a wife, Jochebed, and the woman conceived and bare a son, and when she saw that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. It tells us again in Acts chapter 7 that he was exceedingly fair, and there's a gloss in the column, there's a note there, the translation of that word means he was fair before God. There was something about the kid, not just outwardly, but when they looked at him, they knew this is good, this is right, you know, that it's wrong long to put this child to death, long before the Ten Commandments were written. They had a conviction of right and wrong. And they took the baby boy. Now, Miriam was about 10 years old. Aaron was 3 or 4. And even in the midst of this decree to slaughter the male children, they still conceived and had a son. They moved forward with life and took Moses and for 3 months hid him. I don't know how they kept him quiet, but evidently at 3 months, his lungs were, he was starting to bellow to the point where they couldn't hide him anymore. And you know the story. You saw the movie. They took the basket, and it says they put the clay on the inside and the bitumen, the pitch on the outside, and put him in the river and sent him off. And there Miriam went and watched his 10-year-old sister as this little craft began to float downstream. And we see the issue of the faith of these parents. Says in verse 3, when she could no longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein and laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister stood afar off to watch what would be done with him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself. So God had Pharaoh's daughter wake up that morning and say, man, I need a bath. I just feel a little dirtier than I should. And she walks down to the river, and her maidens walked along by the riverside. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maids to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and notice, very important, behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him. You see, if she opened it up and he was going, she'd have said, oh, look how cute that baby is. But she opened it up and the baby was crying and the tears were streaming down. And it welled up inside of her compassion. Pharaoh's daughter had compassion on this baby. And she said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Then said his sister, now Miriam's there, to Pharaoh's daughter, should I go and call a nurse of the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you? You know, thank God Miriam was 10 years old. If Miriam was 30, she'd have said, now, let's see, what can I do? How can I get in there? How could I, you know, maneuver my, what should I, thank God it was a 10-year-old who said, hey, you want me to find a Jewish mama for this? You know, just right, blunders right in there. And Pharaoh's daughter says one thing, go. Now, you have to realize this is the most remarkable scene because God chooses the foolish things of this world to confound the wise, and the weak things to confound the strong. And there is this plan, this engine behind the scenes of Satan and of Egypt and of Pharaoh. And yet the thread of God's work runs through, it seems at this point in time, the tear of this little child rolling down his cheek, that draws compassion out of the heart of Pharaoh's daughter. And remarkably, it seems to me, contained within that crying, that tear, was the future of the nation of Israel, the coming of Christ into the world, the birth of the church, you and I being saved and sitting here this morning. What a remarkable thread to follow as Pharaoh's daughter's heart is touched at this weeping child. And the Bible says the heathen have all their plans, but it is the counsel of the Lord that shall stand. And you can read Proverbs 19:21 or 21:30, Psalm 33:10 and 11, on and on they go. By this little weeping child, the craft of Satan is defeated, the wisdom of Egypt is defeated, the command of Pharaoh is defeated. And instead of little Moses dying because of a simple act of faith by his parents, Jochebed ends up being hired and getting paid to nurse Moses. Pharaoh, who would destroy the children of Israel, ends up giving room and board and education to their deliverer, raising him up, feeding him, instructing him. And the very thing that Pharaoh and Satan sought to destroy ends up by the hand and the plan of God, the issue of the faith of these two simple people is that he ends up being preserved and enhanced as God enjoys turning the tables, as Satan nailed Jesus Christ to the cross and thought that he had won the battle. He had driven the nail into his own coffin, as it were, because through that victory here you and I sit sealed with the Spirit of promise, with a destiny in glory. But the exhortation to me is simple as I look at this. That is, all excuses are removed from us. He makes the link with the story of these two parents. And all they did, without all the information we have, and without all the literature we have, and without a Bible, they were moved with conviction. Their faith was a simple faith, and they looked into the face of their newborn son. They knew it was wrong for him to die. They trusted in the living God who had somehow encouraged them, and their faith was a living faith, and they took a stand, and they preserved, against odds, the life of this little child. All they did was nurse the child. It was in that realm of the family, unseen, obscure slaves, simply exercising a faith towards God that was a real faith with conviction. Gave life to the one who would not only deliver Israel from Egyptian bondage, but who would deliver so many from darkness to light. Because this revelator, this little baby, would one day put his hand to the page and write, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And he would give us record of Adam and Eve, and of the fall of man, and of the entrance of sin, and of the record of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and of Jochebed, and would put his own story on the page. And I wonder if it was hard for him to write, "Moses was the meekest man that ever lived." If he was the meekest man that ever lived, it'd be hard to write that. And the exhortation is there for us. Is our faith a genuine faith? Doesn't have to be a faith that builds monuments or a scene in the public eye, because God is the one who chooses the weak things of the world to confound the things that are strong, the simple things to confound the wise. And do we belittle what's in our hand today? Do we think little of what God has placed before us? As we look at the children and the relationships and the parents and the people that we work with and what we do at our job, do we kind of look at and despise our circumstances because they're not what we would think in our mind are great things? Or do we realize that the thread of God's handiwork runs through our life and there is no mistake? And that as we look into the eyes of those that are around us, and we look into the way we earn our living and what we do, as we look at our life right now, whether it seems to be falling apart under an era of change and hardship, or whether we seem to be in what we would call the same rut we've been in for a long time, do we look around and realize that in the simplest things, in a tear rolling down someone's cheek around us, the destiny of a nation can be forged and changed? That's why the faith of these two unknown people is placed before us. Because it's just through a simple and a living faith that the living God finds a means to continue an unbroken line of splendor and glory until we stand in his presence. Let's stand and pray.